I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester, his name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast. We're somewhere in the, I don't even know what numbers we're in.
In the 300s, yeah, that's Patrick. He's a blogger, he's an author, he's a podcaster. You can check out his book, Into the Fire, Smith the Game, that's available now. And yeah, you can check him out at ATFMB on the Twitters, and I'm John Anilio, and you can check me out at John Anilio. Today, we're joined by Sebastian DiCastel. He is the author of the acclaimed swashbuckling fantasy series, The Greatcoats. His debut novel, Trade Blade, was shortlisted for both the 2014 Goodreads Choice Award for Best Fantasy and the Gemmo Morningstar Award for Best Debut. The final book in the series, I think it's the final anyway, is The Tyrant's Throne, which is out now. His website is dicastel.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at dicastel. Sebastian, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, fellas. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, well, so this is a book four that's out now. So this is really the final book in the series. Is that correct?
This is really the final book in the series. I was pretty adamant about, no matter what happened, whether it was a success or a flop, that you know, it was going to be a quartet, and that both each book had to have the feeling of being an ending, you know, and having kind of a complete story inside of it, but that the four books had to feel like there was an ending as well. Mostly because at the end of the day, I tend to torture my main character a lot, both literally and figuratively. And there's sort of only so much of that you can do. And also partly because I write swashbuckling adventure fiction at the end of the day. Like it's on the fantasy shelf, but it's the tradition that it's part of is sort of the picaresque tradition of the, you know, Dumas and Sabatini and people like that. And those books didn't go on for 28 books at a time because they tend to be so great. The romances, they were, you know, of course, called romances, not in the sense of a love affair, but in the sense of these kind of idealistic books. And they tend to be so sort of grand, not just in scale, because, you know, epic fantasy tends to be grand in scale, but grand in terms of dramatic action, in terms of the emotionalism of what it gets to. And so once you've done four books with one character, and it's a first person narrative, so it's always Falchio, the main character, saying, you know, I did this and I did that. Once you've taken them through that much drama, you sort of have to give them a break. So Falchio, Celestimbrasti, the three main characters, they'll certainly come back at some point, but they need a break.
I think that's a good strategy, I think, nowadays, because I think people who are big time fantasy and science fiction readers, I think that's a complaint that you hear quite a bit, is that sometimes series go on for too long. And I mean, I know many people that still haven't read any of the George R. R. Martin books because they're like, yeah, but I want to make sure it finishes first, especially with someone
But John, that's no longer a valid argument, because we know that Brandon Sanderson will finish those long series for those guys if something happens to them.
He's the man to do the job, yeah.
he's definitely very skilled, and that is a pretty remarkable skill when you think of it, for Sanderson to be able to go in and finish The Wheel of Time, because I only read the first couple of books in that series. I'm not someone who tends to read long series of fantasy novels, but to go in and have to complete that world. The hardest thing for me about writing Tyrant's Throne was this constant question in my head: am I really tying up all the strings, all the loose ends of, you know, 500,000 words before that final book, of all of these developments and characters and moments and relationships, and you just have to tie it all together. So the fact that Sanderson was able to tie up someone else's series and all of those threads is pretty remarkable.
Oh yeah, and I'll tell you, I did read the entire series. And part of what I was doing at the end, I was trying to figure out, because they were very clear that there was a lot that Jordan had written. And then there was like tons of notes that, because he knew he couldn't finish, he started writing notes for Brandon. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to figure out, where did Jordan end and where did Sanderson begin? I was never able to really figure out like if there was a line. It just blended so well. And the second thing is, I got to meet Brandon Sanderson at Worldcon, and I walked up to him and I shook his hand and I said, thank you, number one. I said, because, you know, without him, that series would not have been completed. And I said, I want to thank you for taking on something that I don't think anyone would just take on. Because it doesn't matter what you do, you're going to have people who hate you. Right? It's just the way that it goes. And I said, so I really admire you, number one, for taking this on and for the phenomenal job you did with it. And I really appreciate it. And I shook his hand. He was very genuinely appreciative of that as well. You know, because I think he did get a lot of shit.
Well, I met him briefly at World Fantasy Convention in 2012, which was, I was there to sign my first book deal, in fact. And I had read Elantris by him, which is a book I really enjoyed. And he seems like a really genuinely nice person. And everybody I know who's met him has said the same thing. He does something that's really great for writers. He teaches a course at Brigham Young University. Yep. I don't know why, but it's like all the Mormons in the world are like these famous sci-fi and fantasy authors. And he allowed that course to be videotaped several times. And you can see his entire course online. And it's really good, you know, like especially if you're starting out and you're trying to sort of figure out how to navigate the path of fantasy or science fiction, how to figure out the language and some of the business. It's a really nice free resource that's out there for people.
He also he does travel and teach at writing conferences as well. And I believe he's one of the co-founders of the Superstars of Writing here in Colorado.
That's cool.
If I'm not mistaken. So, yeah, he does. He's just a super nice guy. He really is.
Yeah, but let's stop plugging him because he's already rich.
I know. I think he gets enough press. Yeah, he seems to be doing fine with the book sales these days. We don't need to devote a whole episode to Brandon Sanders, who's as big a fan as I am. You know, what I want to get on to, first of all, I want to thank all our listeners for listening. And for those of you who back us on Patreon, patreon.com/functionalnerds, that helps us out a lot, helps us put out the show every week. It's really meaningful. If you enjoy the show, if you enjoy listening to interviews with folks like Sebastian here, consider becoming one of our backers. Just go over to patreon.com/functionalnerds. And let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Sebastian, why don't you go first? What's your pick?
I actually have two. One that I just found that I really adore, which is called standardebooks.org. So the URL is just standardebooks.org. And this is a nonprofit, volunteer, sort of crowdsourced community. And what they're doing is they're taking public domain books, all those books that you have in Project Gutenberg, where you know you can go and you can find all these free books. But if you try to read them, it's almost impossible because they're not set up well, they're not well formatted. So what this group is doing is they take those books, they typeset them for ebooks for all the different formats, including, so not just Amazon or the generic formats. They even do a format specifically for Kobo readers. And for people who are outside of the United States, Kobo is actually a really big platform. And they typeset them beautifully. All of the appropriate ebook features are there. They put beautiful covers on them. And so you can pick up one of these kind of classic works of literature and approach it in a really easy, sort of friendly way. I mean, I know it sounds kind of stupid on the surface because you're like, look, the book has always been there. And also you can get the book in the library if you want. But I found for me, it just felt much more comfortable to approach something that I wouldn't normally have read. So for example, I read a book by Agatha Christie. I'm not a big Agatha Christie fan, but I read a book of hers, The Secret Adversary. And I just really loved the experience of reading something that was so well set up. Because even a lot of very professional ebooks from modern publishers come out and you open them up on your e-reader and it's actually kind of hard to read. But these are just really well done. And there's just so much love and care put into it and fixing all of the little mistakes that have crept in when these books were originally put into digital form. And now I'm reading Scaramouche by Sabatini, which is a swashbuckling book that I've never read. And it's a real pleasure. The other one I was going to recommend because it's kind of weird for an author who's hawking his books to say, hey, here, go buy get these free books instead, because it's completely free. You can download all these books without paying a nickel for them. But another book I read recently is Daryl Gregory's Spoonbenders. Daryl Gregory won, I think it was a World Fantasy Award, for a really fabulous novella called We Are All Completely Fine. And he's this guy that comes up with really interesting premises for these. They're not quite fantasy. They're not quite science fiction. They're sort of set in our world, but there's just these elements of the fantastical or the supernatural that creep in. And Spoonbenders is about this family of kind of failed psychics, you know, one of these families that would show up on the Mike Douglas show in the 1970s, like one of those TV variety shows, and show off their magic tricks. And it's them sort of about 15 years after they were totally humiliated on the stage by a guy who was kind of the equivalent of the Amazing Randy, who's a big skeptic of the supernatural. And so it's just about their lives and what they do. And it all culminates in a fun sort of fantastical thing, but it's this really interesting blend of character-driven story. You know, when we think of literary novels, we often think of ordinary characters dealing with ordinary situations. And Gregory does this really remarkable thing where he writes about extraordinary characters in ordinary situations and deals with it with such humanity that it's just a really great read. I highly recommend Spoonbenders.
I'm a friend with Daryl on Facebook, and I saw him just post a photo of Spoonbenders, him citing it in a airport bookstore, which was very exciting. I know that's a big accomplishment. That and like Walmart, I think for authors, like once your book's getting there, you're reaching a new level. So it's funny. Yeah. I just saw that yesterday.
Oh, you're right. Let's not plug him either then.
Yeah, I know. What you're plugging all these guys. They don't need the plug. But no, that's great. Both those. I'm very curious about the ebook because I tend to buy most of my ebooks on Amazon, and I have like a NetGalley thing where a publisher send me access to stuff, and NetGalley is pretty good, but sometimes what kind of like what you said, sometimes when you're dealing with the, you know, whether it's eARCs or what have you, sometimes the formatting is very weird, especially if it's a nonfiction book. And if there's any kind of charts or graphs or pictures or something like that, that stuff can just go haywire in an e-reader. So it's nice to hear that there's this service out there. Cause yeah, there are a lot of pieces of classic, you know, public domain stuff that I'm always curious about. And then you do see that stuff show up on Amazon, but there'll be 10 different versions of it and price points from like 20 cents to $15. And you're like, well, I don't know which one to get here. They're all, you know, so it's kind of nice to see that there's this resource of sort of that's run by people that are into it and want to do a good job with it. So I will definitely look into that. So both good recommendations. Patrick, what's your recommendation this week?
I'm still going in my head. Scaramouche, will you do the fandango?
First thing I thought of too.
Betty, Betty, frightening me.
I thought the same thing.
I thought that was a cue, and we were all going
to
go.
I thought so. I was waiting for John to start singing, but he never sings on the show. He's you know, the whole thing about the cobbler's kids who have no shoes. John never sings for us.
He's a pro, and he don't sing for no. Without yeah, money, man. Exactly.
And when he does, he does it like really like fake. So
yeah,
I'm picking a Netflix show that it seems like online, it's like. There's no gray. It's black or white. People either love it or hate it. Mm-hmm. And that's The Oa.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And yeah, I haven't seen it, but you're right. I've only seen It's Awesome or It's Horrible. Right.
It's a trip. It's definitely a trip, and I'm enjoying it. I started getting into it because someone else told me how much they loved it and just insisted that I start watching it. So I started watching it. I'm enjoying it. It starts out, it's about a character who has been gone for, I think, 7 years. Mm-hmm. And comes back, and her family like goes and finds her at the hospital, and they take her home, and you think it's like this adjustment, but she's not really adjusting. She just wants to get back to wherever she was before. And it's just, I don't know how to describe it. It's very like low key, but intense. And there's lots of stuff going on. And there's definitely science fiction and fantasy elements to it. I suggest you at least watch the first episode and give it a shot. I don't know what else to say.
I've actually watched the whole first season, and I'm kind of a fan of Britt Marling, who is both the actress, and I think she probably wrote it, or
she wrote it, directed it, produced it, everything. Yeah.
So her and her partner, and I'm going to mangle his name, so I apologize. I think it's Zach Batmanghili. Mm. They specialize in creating these really imaginative films on incredibly small budgets. They did a film called Another Earth,
yes,
which used to be on Netflix as well. And it's a sci-fi film that's entirely character-driven that has almost no special effects, because it's basically the discovery that there is another Earth on the other side of the sun that, because of all of these heliosynchronicities, you know, they haven't encountered before. And they figure out a way that, you know, certain people will get to go to that other Earth, if they win this sort of contest. But it's mostly about this woman who, when she was younger, got in a car accident and killed this guy's child by accidentally, and the horrible grief she experiences when she ends up meeting him, not telling him who she is, and all this stuff. But what's amazing is what I love about her stuff, and what I think people will enjoy about the OA, is that it's imaginative, it's speculative, it's got the sci-fi elements, but you're entirely focused on the characters.
Yes, yeah, and there's a lot of different characters in this that you just like, ooh, you know, because there's so much going on. That's why I'm saying it's pretty dense.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I love, there's a moment in the last episode that I just adored. It brought a tear to my eye. Uh-huh. That's those, you know, which I won't spoil for anyone, but it's a slow burn, yeah. But it's worthwhile.
Yep.
Cool. A little aside with that. I believe the person that does the score for that is the guy from The Vampire Weekend, which I don't know if he's related to Britt Marling's partner there. I think his name is Raj Batman-Gile. I'm not exactly sure. He was the keyboard player and guitar player in that band, The Vampire Weekend, which had some success a few years back. Knew those guys a little bit. I played with this bass player 15 years ago. His name was Spencer Miles. His brother is a guy named Wes Miles, who's the lead singer of this band called Rah Rah Riot. And they grew up in this little town in New Jersey, not far from where I live. And when I was rehearsing with Spencer, when we were in our early 20s, these guys were like 14, 15. And they were like the little kids, like playing with their like synthesizers in the corner. And we were like scoffed at them. And of course, Spencer and I didn't have any real success in music, but these two guys both went. And one guy was in The Vampire Weekend and one guy was in this band Rah Rah Riot and had a lot of success. And now I think Raj, the guy from Vampire Weekend, I think he's doing a lot of scoring now. And I'm pretty sure he's the guy that scored the OA. So little fun fact there. My pick, another kind of music pick, but a book, is by Martin Popoff. He writes a lot of these music books. And it is, everyone who listens to the show regularly knows that I'm a big Rush fan. And this is just a book called Rush Album by Album. It is an oral history. I've read a lot of these music oral histories these days, and it is exactly what the title suggests. It goes through all 20 of the Rush studio albums, because if you get into the live albums and the compilations, it's like 50 albums. But if you just do the 20 studio albums, they just go through and they have various people, the four or five people that'll talk about each album. And if you're a fan, it's a really interesting read just to hear some insights about it, some a little bit about the making of, a little bit about sort of cultural impact. I really enjoyed it. I read the ebook of it. However, I did see the print version in the Barnes & Noble by my house, and I may end up picking up that because there's a lot of nice photos in it, and it's a really nice laid out. It's a large book. So if you are a Rush fan, I recommend it. It's nice because it's kind of got me back into exploring a little bit of it. I, as big of a fan of as I am, I kind of didn't listen much to the last three albums that they put out, which that's over like a pretty long period because they kind of took a long break in there. So it's kind of got me back to explore those albums and the first couple of albums, because I didn't really get on board till like 2112. So it's a good, if you're a fan, it's nice to revisit. If you're not a fan, this book is going to mean nothing to you. But if you are a fan, it's a good read.
John, sure. Does the author take you through it nice and slow, or do they kind of rush through the whole thing?
Nice. It's an oral history, Patrick.
Failed to point out, John, that Rush is a Canadian band.
Absolutely. Well, I was going to, that was one of the, I had a couple of different things picked. I'm like, oh, Sebastian's a musician and Canadian. What a fitting pick for me.
Isn't Rush the other Canadian band? Wasn't there like two?
No, we have three. There's Brian Adams, Bare Naked Ladies, and Rush.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. We have three.
There's another big one that often gets brought up that was not big here. I'm not going to remember it now. Cause I feel like even the Rush guys were big fans of them.
Tragically Hip.
Yes, that's it. Exactly. That's like the big Canadian band that often gets mentioned that had a little success down here, but were pretty big.
There's two kinds of Canadians. There's the Canadians that are kind of semi-reviled in their own country, but become famous elsewhere.
Celine Dion.
Celine Dion. Nothing wrong with Celine Dion, but but you know, she sets foot across the border. No, it's there's just that tendency amongst Canadians to really resent people who get above themselves, which is anybody who can afford to live on their art. And then there's those kind of homegrown, like, you know, we have a sort of a love affair with them. They're so purely Canadian in our own minds, who then often don't break out in other parts of the world. Tragically Hip, in some ways, right now, certainly, because there's a whole rich story to them and to Gord Downie, the lead singer. They are, in a way, the quintessential kind of Canadian band, you know, in the Canadian consciousness right now. And they are terrific. They are worth checking out. And even if you don't like Rush, just if you're a science fiction or fantasy fan, just read Neil Peart's lyrics because they are so bizarrely sophisticated. You could learn a lot about the craft of writing any type of medium just by looking at his lyrics.
See, my publisher is Wordfire Press, which is Kevin J. Anderson. So I hear about Neil Peart a lot.
There's a lot of like stories of like him and Neil Peart going hiking.
Oh God, yes.
That kind of stuff, right? That's cool. Yeah, no, I in sort of re-exploring their catalog, I am struck by how, I mean, I always liked the lyrics a lot, but how well a lot of it really holds up, considering some of it was written so long ago and some of it was very either topical or, you know, story based, or, you know, there's like, you know, being a musician, I always focused so much more on the music than the lyrics. And now this is making me go and, you know, dig deeper into the lyrics and how meaningful they are, and how each album, even the ones that weren't concept albums, there was usually a theme for the album that he wrote around. So they, even though it wasn't like stories being connected, there was a theme being connected. So even like through like Counterparts and Roll the Bones and like sort of those 90s, early 2000s albums, really connected. I'm like, wow, this is really something. The lyrics, I always just sort of like, oh, this is like not a concept album, but it's cool. It's all good. But now to see how they're connected and a little bit of the thought process behind it. Yeah, it's, you're right. There's a wealth of material to dig into there for sure. You know, speaking of music, so as we're, our listeners cannot see this obviously, but behind him, Sebastian has probably the things that would appeal to so many people that are listeners of the show. He has a guitar and he has two swords back there, at least two that are visible.
Are they swords or are they rapiers? Or are they the same thing?
Well, rapiers are a type of sword. So one's a rapier and one's a small sword. Actually, I don't know why they're there. We were living in the Netherlands for a year, and so when we moved back last year, me being quintessentially an 8-year-old, never quite put any, you know, my office back together. So so my walls are completely bare, and I've got, you know, swords hanging around all over the place. But I used to fence quite a bit, and then I did fight choreography in the theater. So you just naturally end up accumulating swords, which are helpful if you get an intruder at 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, they wouldn't really be helpful because actually if you're in a narrow hallway, like once you've opened your door and an intruder's there, you know, a 41 inch sword blade is not the best device, but it does make an impression.
Is it better than what I have, which is essentially sonic screwdrivers?
I'm glad you told me there was a sonic screwdriver because it looked like something else entirely.
Yeah, right.
You know, I was going to ask you, Sebastian, about your work as a fight choreographer. Now, you said you did that for theater mostly, or did you do it for television and movies as well?
No, it was almost entirely theater. It's funny that, you know, when you become an author, of course, there's this wonderful act of publicity synecdoche where like one part of your existence becomes the sum total because it's maybe the only interesting thing about you. So if it hadn't been the sword fighting thing, it would have been the fact that I was an archaeologist for all of 4 hours. I used to fence. I mean, everybody who fences, eventually you get into things like theatrical fencing, which is sort of, you know, these sort of plays with swords, as it were. And then I was asked to choreograph, a local community production of Dangerous Liaisons Dangereuses, as we say here. And the two actors had never held swords in their lives that I was working with, but the three of us were just so excited. We became really good friends. We're like, we're going to choreograph the hell out of this. And it was like the fastest sword fight in all of sort of Canadian theater at that moment, you know, when they were doing it, and it was the best performance, all this drama, and like, you know, and it was funny because it's in this tiny little community theater and most people are sort of there, you know, because it's a $5 show. But they were just, they did such a fantastic job. And anyway, then I went on to do more stuff. And actually the funny thing is, I always say, like, in any creative art, you know, like, the extra effort that you put into something beyond what's required is becomes these kind of karma points, because one of those actors ended up being the lead in a production of Richard III in the West End in London, in England. And the producer was this young American guy who said to him, like, oh, you know, who are we going to get to choreograph this thing? And he said, I know just the guy, but we have to fly him out from Canada. And so it was hilarious because I had just been in London certifying, you know, with you can certify as an actor combatant, which means you've passed certain tests. And I had just gone through a little certification program and done a pretty mediocre job. And then all of a sudden I was back there and all of my teachers who were there were like, how did you get this gig? So it was a fun process, and fight choreography teaches you a lot about story. So
I'm just curious, when you go into a situation like that, where you're going to, you know, do the choreography for a production, how often do you encounter authors who, as soon as they get that, or actors, as soon as they get that sword in their hand, they start making lightsaber noises?
Oh, not too often, actually, because usually you start by giving people the safety talk. Mm. And you start by saying, like, one wrong move and your face is going to look all wrong for television. Because it does, you know, because we forget that it's they're dangerous weapons. A sharpened blade doesn't have to be sharp to be deadly. Mm. And generally speaking, you're working with blunted weapons, but they're not fake weapons. Because actually really fake weapons are dangerous. If you make something out of some ultra lightweight sort of faux metal, it breaks too easily. And the second that something like that breaks, it becomes deadly sharp. So you have to teach people when someone's going to, you know, when you see an actor, especially in a theater production, when you see an actor doing a sword fight, they have had to learn how to actually sword fight. The training for actor combatants is largely built off the training that people used to get in the 16th and 17th century when they learned how to defend themselves with swords. So it's a scary process sometimes. So yeah, once I give them that speech, I don't get a lot of lightsaber noises.
You know, going over to your background as a musician then as well. So when did the music start for you? Is that something that started when you were a younger person and you kept up with it, or was that something later in life?
I've always had the weirdest musical career. So my older brother, John, is one of the best guitar players I've ever seen. He would tell you that this is not true, but he is. He's just, when you watch him play, it's killer. And as a little kid, I'd watch him play. And he was also like the coolest guy I had ever seen in my life. He's still cool. He's in his 60s. He's got hair that runs down to his butt, and he still looks incredibly cool somehow. And so I kept wanting to be like him, but I never quite could do it. And then when I was about 18, or 19, my roommate, who had been learning some classical guitar, was playing Greensleeves. And I mean, Greensleeves is something that we all think of as a pretty hackneyed kind of tune, you know, da 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 da. You know, it's the thing reputed to have been written by Henry VIII that almost certainly wasn't. So I really wanted to learn that. And I learned that on the classical guitar. And then within 3 months, I was on stage in a rock band playing these really rough bars in the interior of British Columbia. And then it just never stopped. The thing about live music, and I think it's hard for people who aren't musicians to sort of really relate to it, but there's a feeling that happens. And if you're lucky, you might get it for 30 seconds of one night of a show. Like for 30 seconds, you might have this moment where everything's so in the pocket that nobody's thinking about what they're doing, but they're all just there. And you might have four people on stage, but you hear eight instruments. And that moment for me, that is the single biggest high, you know, that I can imagine. And so I still play. I'm doing a show with an 80s band on the 26th of this month at a supper club of all things. And I still play no matter, you know, I'll cancel almost anything else to play a live show. And it's because that feeling is just, it's the closest thing to magic I can get to.
That's awesome.
You know, you mentioned that like kind of 30 second thing, and I agree with you. It reminded me of a book and a documentary. I don't know if you read it or saw it. It's by Daniel Levitin. He wrote a book about what's going on in your brain in terms of music, when you're playing music. He was a record producer who went back and got a PhD in neuroscience. So he had sort of both these things. But in the doc, which I think was on PBS, they had someone in an MRI machine, and they had the guy in the MRI machine and someone outside of it, and they were singing harmony with each other. And when you're, especially if you're singing harmony, where I think this is what kind of you're talking about there, where you're kind of connecting and you're anticipating and you're matching, you know, there was certain parts of the brain that were just like really lighting up way more than anything else. It was really quite interesting to see how the impact playing music, but not only playing music, but playing it with other people, that connection that really sort of ignites our brain. So I think that's a little connected to what you're talking about, even if it's just that 30 seconds of a gig, you know?
You know, I call it the wonder. And I think we can find it in lots of different places. For me, like when I first wrote Trader's Blade, which is the first book in the Greatcoats Quartet, I hadn't planned on writing it. I was doing a thing called the 3-day novel writing contest that happens around the world every year. It was just for a lark. I hadn't even known what I was doing. And I just wrote for like 72 hours straight. And I wrote, and I just connected to this feeling where all of a sudden I was writing stuff. I didn't know what was coming out of my head. I was crying at the sad scenes. I was laughing at my own jokes. I mean, I looked like a complete moron, but I was in this sort of state of experiencing that kind of wonder. And whether it has a neurochemical parallel to what we were talking about music and harmony, I'm not sure. But to me, that's like the quest of human life. Like everything that I do in life, you know, I do a lot of travel and I sort of try to find adventures in different careers. It's all to kind of experience that sense of wonder. And you know, people can get it from a lot of different places. I see people get it, you know, hanging out with their kids, or, you know, studying something or whatever. But that's kind of the focus. That's what took me into writing. And that's what was kind of the big pleasure of the Great Quote series, was just all those moments of wonder. Like if I wasn't getting those, like we were talking about before, you know, when people write, you know, 28 books in a series, and if they're still getting those moments of wonder, then I'm totally on board. I'm like, that's justification enough for it. But if they weren't, I don't know what I would do. I would find it really painful to try to write an entire novel, because, you know, they're a fair chunk of work. If I wasn't getting those moments of wonder, of just like that sense of like, I just wrote something that feels so true to me that I've like connected to something inside me that I wasn't sure was there. And that's the closest I get to that feeling of being on stage sometimes with a band. And it's funny because I'm not even a great musician. I'm like, you know, I'm a good performer. But yeah, the wonder, that's kind of what it's all about.
Wow, I can't think of a better way to kind of end it than on that. That's wonderful. You know, and before we do wrap it up, what I do want to say is one of the reasons I was excited to get Sebastian on the show is within science fiction and fantasy circles, these books are universally praised, at least amongst the people that I've sort of associate with online and book reviewer friends and other podcasters and things like that. These books are always super highly recommended. I have them all here. I haven't started yet because there's so many books, but it's always been on. I've always been interested. Now I'm even more interested, especially with all your background and the way that you look at the world. It's something that I'm looking forward to diving into. So book one is The Trader's Blades. That's where, if people have not read them yet, start there. And if you have and you haven't gotten the new book, which is Tyrant's Throne, go and get that now too. So Sebastian, it was a pleasure having you on today. Again, your website is decastel.com. You are at decastel on Twitter. Is there anything else you want to let our listeners know before we have to go?
You know, I love all the letters and emails that I get. I get sort of, I'm not super famous, but I get sort of one a day. Progressively, they're all asking me when the next Greatcoats book is going to be. We're sort of in negotiations about a new series that would feature different characters. Because as I said, I got to give poor Falchio a break from all the pain and suffering. But please stop asking me to write Falchio Castambrasti stories for just a little while. In the meantime, though, Spellslinger is out, which is my new sort of YA magic series, where I'm trying to do with the subject of magic what I was trying to do with the subject of swashbuckling with the greatcoats. So yeah, so if you're looking for something from me, there's that. There's Spellslinger, and then Shadow Black comes out in October, and there's two books a year in that series, so I can keep you busy for a while.
Nice. Any cons that you'll be making appearances at coming up?
Yeah, I'm flying out to London for first one of the coolest events in London, which is called Fantasy in the Court, which is this casual wine and cheese thing that happens at Goldsborough Books, which is one of the coolest bookstores in the planet. So if you're anywhere near London, or you're as rich as John and Patrick, then fly out for that. And then I'm at Nine Worlds, which is also in London. And then I'll be at Worldcon in Helsinki. And then I'm at the Edinburgh Literary Festival, which are very nice people who I don't know why, but decided to fly me out. So I'll be there. I'm not at any cons in the States coming up, but I would certainly love to do one. So hopefully in the near future.
Excellent. Awesome. So if you are going to be in Europe, go see Sebastian live. Again, for us, thanks. If you dig the show, just go to patreon.com/functionalnerds and consider becoming one of our backers. Patrick, anything you want to mention before we roll?
Nope.
All right, everybody. Sebastian, thank you again. Really appreciate it. And everyone else, have a great week.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.